Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Dr. Amish Adalja. Dr. Adalja is a senior scholar at Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, an adjunct assistant professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and an affiliate of Johns Hopkins Center for Global Health. His work is focused on emerging infectious disease, pandemic preparedness, and biosecurity. And with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Adalja.
Thanks for having me.
No, thank you for being here. The past few years have certainly been quite exciting, both from a health policy standpoint and in terms of vaccine misinformation and disinformation. And on that note, I'd like to talk a little bit about those factors and glean your insights. So for starters, how has this flu season been? We've heard a lot about COVID-19 variants, RSV, influenza, which I generally lump together as flu season, whether rightfully or wrongfully. How has each virus contributed to the overall severity of this year's flu season?
So right now, if you look at respiratory virus season, we're seeing circulation of COVID, RSV, and influenza. And what I can say is that COVID and RSV are the big players so far this year. Influenza has started to tick up, but it hasn't been a major player yet. It probably will be. Remember, the traditional peak of influenza season is February, so we're still several months away from that. But there are some states, for example, Alaska, and also the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico, that have had a pretty bad influenza, have had pretty bad influenza outbreaks. But what we do know is that RSV is increasing. It started in the South, it started early, and it's moved all around the country. And COVID has always been kind of at a simmer, and it has some ups and downs. It was up just before the respiratory virus season, then it went down, and now it seems to be going back up. But this is the norm. We're going to always see these respiratory viruses jockeying for the lead. And I think now we're at more or less the normal status quo for what we'll see in the future. And it's not going to be like those interrupted seasons of influenza or other viruses that we saw during the height of COVID, where only COVID was spreading. They're all going to be in there. And I think that people need to get acclimatized to it. But we've got more tools than ever to be acclimatized to these viruses. And I think that's the real story here.
Understood. You mentioned about peak influenza season happening in a few months. Is it possible now, kind of given where we are with COVID-19, and as you had mentioned, cycling in of multiple viral variants, can we start to have some sense of when the peak seasons of COVID, RSV, and influenza will occur, or is that still dynamic?
Well, we know that the pandemic scrambled all of the other viruses in terms of the social distancing, the masking that we use for COVID also changed the way that those other viruses circulated. And for example, last year, we had a really outsized level of RSV in children because the pool of susceptible children kept growing and growing because they hadn't had their first RSV bout. And usually the first RSV bout is the most severe. But now that's sort of all behind us. So I do think we'll probably get to some traditional metrics now. So probably February for influenza. RSV is a little bit earlier than that. COVID will eventually probably settle into a seasonal pattern, but it hasn't quite done that. There's some seasonality to it. We know that it goes up in the winter when it gets very cold. And we know that it also goes up in the summer when it gets very hot and people go indoors. But we don't have that full seasonality yet. So it's unclear when COVID-19 is going to have, you know, what month will be the peak. It's going to vary. But I think eventually it will settle down to be like the other community-acquired coronaviruses that have very much a similar pattern to RSV, to influenza. But we're not quite there yet, but you can start to see the outlines of it.
Understood. On that note, given the dynamic nature and almost a learning in progress, if you will, approach to these types of viruses, it's inevitable that there's going to be a certain level of consternation among the public. I feel that many individuals and much of the public is fed up with vaccines. Belief in conspiracy theories are steadily rising. How do you discuss vaccine efficacy, the new data around RSV vaccines for babies, new influenza vaccine strains, given that there's a lot of misinformation and kind of a willingness to buy into that misinformation? How do you parse through the facts, the data, and the misbeliefs and try to create one coherent understanding for patients?
The first thing I try to do is be clear on what a vaccine is going to accomplish, what a vaccine can do and what it can't do, what we expect it to do only temporarily, and what we expect it to do durably, and explain how that differs for different vaccines. For example, the measles vaccine, after your two doses of that, you're going to get durable immunity for life, and that immunity is going to protect against infection. But for other viruses, like influenza, like COVID, where it's a respiratory virus that's constantly mutating, the goal isn't so much to block infection, but to take something that what could be severe and shift it to the milder side. The CDC uses the phrase, taking something that's wild and making it mild. And that's what I'm clear on, that the flu that you get, despite the vaccine, is a much easier flu to cope with than if you weren't vaccinated. And the same is true for COVID-19 vaccines. But I'm also clear about where the vaccines are of benefit. So I don't necessarily think that having a healthy person continue to get updated COVID-19 vaccines is going to make much of a difference. What we really want to do is target COVID-19 vaccines to the high risk of whatever age group that might be. Because what we're trying to do here is not necessarily block infection, which the vaccines only do with COVID for a couple of months in the age of Omicron. But what we're trying to do is keep people out of the hospital. But have a risk for hospital, you have to have a risk for hospitalization to actually achieve that benefit. So I think that the approach that they used in the United Kingdom and the EU with targeting these newer COVID vaccines to the high risk makes a lot more sense than what we did, because I think it actually ends up undermining people's confidence. When you make a universal recommendation, but not everybody's going to benefit from that, it really feeds into the conspiratorial non-thinking that goes on that says, oh, this is just some kind of big pharma scheme, or this is the government trying to control you. But if we say, this is who the vaccine benefits, these are who should be people who be in line, this is what it does, this is what it doesn't do, I think you can get there. But what we know is that the anti-vaccine movement isn't very receptive to facts or rationality or reasoning. They don't even view the scientific method as a legitimate way to look at the world. So I think sometimes you can't reach certain individuals, but I think with people that are merely vaccine hesitant, or when you're talking to just a general audience, I think it's really clear to give them that ammunition. And I think too much of the pandemic was one size fits all solutions and didn't allow for these nuanced discussions that end up opening the door for vaccine conspiracies to start, because people are using very blunt terms and not being as nuanced and precision guided as they need to be. And that's sort of what I try to do. One correction, you said an RSV vaccine for babies. There's no RSV vaccine for babies. There's an RSV monoclonal antibody for babies, and there's an RSV vaccine for pregnant women, as well as an RSV vaccine for older adults. But we do not yet have an RSV vaccine for children.
Thank you for correcting me. That is an important distinction, so I appreciate the correction. In that vein, as you just mentioned, different vaccines mitigate against different aspects of a viral severity or a viral infection. Is that then the reason why, if I were a patient and I were to ask you a very simple question, why are there so many vaccines for so many different viral strains? Is the answer really that each vaccine interacts with the virus in a unique way so that you as the patient don't get the worst of the symptoms or the worst of the infectivity?
So in general, when a vaccine is updated to include a new strain or a different strain, it's meant to match that strain better so that the efficacy, the protection you get, is more durable and stronger. So that's why flu vaccines are updated annually based on what types of viruses are circulating, to make sure that you're still getting that high level of efficacy against prevention of severe disease. With COVID vaccines, there's some argument about whether or not vaccines needed to be updated because the original ancestral vaccine was still protecting against severe disease. But we've had now two updates to that vaccine. And I think there is an academic argument there. But the general point is that when you're updating a vaccine, you're trying to give increased strength of protection with it. And the antibodies, the T cells, the immune system's reaction to an updated vaccine is going to be more precision guided. In theory, or what you hope, is that it's going to be more directed against the strains that are circulating, so you get more protection for a longer period of time.
Understood. Thank you, sir. I want to transition and talk a little bit about how experts like yourself glean the information that you do. And I think that would be helpful in the conversation to understand and really combat misinformation and disinformation. So at a very basic high level, for the listening public, Can you explain how experts like yourself evaluate flu severities? Do you reference databases like the World Health Organization recommendations, look at trends in Australia or something else? Just discuss a little bit about how predictions are made and how those predictions determine which vaccines are recommended and their formularies and things of that nature.
So with flu, you really have to look at this as a virus that circulates year-round. Even though we are speaking here in the Northern Hemisphere and entering our respiratory or in the midst of our respiratory virus season, there's a whole other half of the globe that has the opposite seasons. So you can use the information from one season, one side of the globe to inform the other side of the globe's vaccine decisions because the virus is constantly circulating. It doesn't go anywhere. And in the tropics, it circulates year-round. So you're constantly looking at data from epidemiologists, from flu virologists that are characterizing the strains of flu that are infecting people and seeing how close they are to what's in the vaccine, how close they are to what circulated last year, and whether or not there needs to be an update in the vaccine. Because when you do experiments, that the antibodies that are generated from last season's vaccine don't really match or don't really completely block infection or severe disease with the current strain circulating. So you're constantly looking at that data and understanding what's circulating. And some of that data comes from the World Health Organization. Some of it comes from the CDC. Some of it comes from academic labs that are doing sequencing. And there's a special group of advisors that the WHO has in place that's looking at those streams of data to come up with the best decision. And you have to remember that flu vaccines are not the best of our vaccines in terms of the technology and the method that we make them. And there's a long lead time needed. So you have to pick what strains are going to include well before the actual season. And anything can happen in that tail end of the season. And then you end up with a mismatched vaccine. So this is a problem, but it is the best guess that we have. And hopefully new technologies will allow us to decrease that lead time so that we can be much more nimble with making sure that the right strains are in the vaccine. And the other thing is that maybe eventually we will have a universal flu vaccine that doesn't need this type of updating. So we won't have to keep such an eye on the virus, because the virus is always going to mutate. And I think this is the best thing that we have, but it does involve a lot of data crunching and prediction, which can be wrong, and it has been wrong.
Understood. So in many ways, this is as much an art as it is a science, to paraphrase Sir William Osler, who coincidentally was one of the progenitors of building the Johns Hopkins Medical Institution. In terms of public looks at vaccines.
I was going to say, I wouldn't call it completely. I mean, there is a scientific base to it. It's not a blind guess. It's a guess based on data or an inference based on data. So it's not completely arbitrary. But yes, there is an element of uncertainty in it.
Understood. In terms of how that uncertainty appears to the public and what the public tends to react to and not react to on a year-by-year basis, it varies, and often that's a political variation. How does public sentiment affect policymaking among experts like yourself? Do you make considerations or provisions for how the public would react when offering guidance?
Ideally, no, that the recommendation is what the recommendation is. However, you have to remember that you are making a recommendation for people who have varied lives, who have different values, who have different risk tolerances. So what you want to do is be really clear that your recommendation is a recommendation that people have to then integrate into their own value hierarchy of how they live their life. That some people may really be trying to avoid getting malaria, for example, when they're going somewhere. Some other people may not care. But what you do is you give people information so they can make informed decisions. And you have to recognize that not everybody's going to be able to do everything that you recommend. And we learned this, for example, with HIV and sexually transmitted infections, that abstinence-only recommendations don't work. People will not follow them. So there's a whole concept called harm reduction that we use in HIV, with sexually transmitted infections, with injection drug users, where we teach people how to do things safer, give them tools to be able to live their life amid some risk, whether that risk is HIV, hepatitis C, influenza, COVID, malaria, cholera, whatever it is. You have to give people a toolbox. So yes, the recommendations, what you need to do is science-based. It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with public sentiment, but you have to recognize that your recommendation is now going to be implemented by a person, and that person needs to have options available into it. So you might say, if you don't want to get malaria, do not go to an area where there is malaria. But what if someone says, well, I have to go to a place where there's malaria. I'm going on vacation there. It's really important to me. What do? We give them tools. We say, these are the drugs you need to take. You should use insect bed net. You should use insect repellent. So that's what I think is sometimes lost when people gave recommendations during COVID-19, where it was never do this, never visit your grandmother, never do this, never go to school, never do this in person. And people wouldn't follow that, and it drives the behavior underground. So you do have to take public sentiment into consideration when you're trying to build something for humans that are going to, you're not just answering a question, an essay question on the test of what do you do? It's how do you give people tools to live their life? Because while you might be an infectious disease doctor, an epidemiologist, where the only thing you're thinking about is this disease spreading, but other people have to live their lives and they've got other competing priorities. And I think that's the important part that is you don't think about, you know, public sentiment doesn't change what the actual efficacy or what you're recommending is, but it does change how well it gets implemented. So you need to have options there and recognize that these are humans that have to live their lives and are not just kind of playing a video game where they're trying to stop a virus from spreading.
Understood. Dr. Dalja, in the remaining time that we have, I'd like to ask some more conjectural questions, really just trying to glean more of your opinion, because I think that would be helpful for the audience as we're going into the 2024 year, being an election year. A lot of political dynamism is going to affect health and health policy. Do you see the election year, 2024, having any impact on, as we discussed, public sentiment when it comes to vaccine behavior?
I do, and it's unfortunate because what we have are a group of candidates that are really sowing misinformation about COVID-19 vaccines, and we even have a major candidate in the form of RFK Jr., what his platform plank is about is anti-vaccine conspiratorial non-thinking. So I do think that there is a lot of this. If you look, for example, at the Republican candidates running for president, they are all attacking what is one of the greatest vaccine success stories in the history of the world, the COVID-19 vaccines. You have the leading Republican candidate, former President Trump, whose administration had a success with Operation Warp Speed, had the foresight to put together Operation Warp Speed running from that very success. So we're sort of in this paradoxical situation where the person one of the architects of Operation Warp Speed doesn't even want to claim it, even though it saved countless lives. So yes, I do think that the 2024 election season with the Republican candidates, as well as RFK Jr. In the mix, is going to energize the anti-vaccine movement. And it is going to be a time when there is lots of misinformation spread and a lot of pandering to what I call, you know, the voices of the dark ages that don't believe in vaccines. And that's what you're seeing in many different forms. And I think that's not a good, that doesn't portend good for the future, because vaccines are probably or arguably one of the greatest technologies that humans have ever invented. And to discard them or to throw them away really is the cry of the primitive. It's a return to the primitive.
Well said. Just like to note that former President Trump did get the COVID vaccines himself, despite some of the rhetoric that may be available on public media channels.
I suspect all of those candidates who are attacking the vaccine were vaccinated. This is just pandering and theater.
Yeah, it's interesting if that is the case. As a human, as an individual who and takes pride in the work that you do, this must affect you to a certain degree. How has this rise in vaccine disinformation, misinformation, however you want to characterize it, how has it affected how you communicate with patients, how you practice medicine? Talk a little bit about how it's affected you at a human level.
Well, as a doctor, it hasn't changed anything I've done. I advocate for the vaccines based on the evidence that's in front of me and the patient that I'm recommending them to, or not recommending to, depending upon what that situation may be. That hasn't changed. But in terms of the personal attacks that I get, the harassment on social media, the harassment in person, all of that has been difficult. Some of the people I don't speak to anymore that were friends or acquaintances, that all adds up And a lot of it has to do with their stance on the vaccines and their disbelief of scientific evidence. So yes, it does take a toll. But I think I like being an infectious disease doctor on the forefront, fighting against, you know, trying to push back nature from humans. Allowing, if you think about infectious diseases, that's what's really capped our lifespans as a species forever. And I like being on the vanguard of people trying to claim that back, to push us further and to put the microbial world on notice as best we can, that humans are going to flourish despite living on a planet that has bacteria, viruses, fungi that outnumber us by, you know, a number that's probably too high to even conceptualize. The fact that humans can flourish has to do with people in the infectious disease field, the icons of our field, like Louis Pasteur and Robert Koch and D.A. Henderson and so many more, Tony Fauci and Robert Gallo, and all, I can't stop naming them all. The fact that I'm on that team is what helps me to push aside all the nonsense of these voices from the dark ages, the middle age voices of the voices of the middle ages, where science was something feared and forbidden. That they don't matter in the long run. What matters are defending people like Louis Pasteur and Edward Jenner and D.A. Henderson and Tony Fauci, all of those types of people. That's what motivates me.
Well, well said. With the remaining time that we have, I'd like to ask one question that is really for what I would like to call the middle majority that often tends to be silenced in a lot of this bombastic rhetoric. The folks who take information and try to parse as intelligible an opinion as they can with the information that's available. What guidance or recommendations would you offer to these patients about recognizing and debunking conspiracy theories as they appear to them?
So it's very hard for somebody that's not trained in medicine and science. And even we see in our own field of medicine and science, there are people that have great credentials that are purveying misinformation and outright lies. So it's very difficult if you're a person that doesn't have that type of training. But what I do, you know, we say, you know, trusted sources, but it's hard for people to figure out who a trusted source is. So what you have to do is kind of look at the sources that you're getting information from and try and understand, does this sound credible? Is this completely different than anything I've heard everywhere else? Does it integrate with what I know about the world and what I remember from science? Does it integrate with what my primary care doctor is telling me, what other doctors that I've trusted in the past have told me? But it's very hard because it's a technical field and it's hard for people to have completely first-handed thinking. But what they can do is try and look and see what type of evidence people are giving for their arguments, what type of evidence they're pointing to, or are they not even pointing to evidence? They may just be saying anecdotes. They might say, my uncle something, something did that. That's not evidence. Are people pointing to evidence or are they pointing to anecdotes? That would be important, but it's very, very difficult to do that. I think in general, the mainstream media is fairly reliable when it comes to this type of information. And in most of the medical societies, including the Infectious Disease Society of America, the CDC, are all good sources of information, but it can be very, very difficult. And what I would tell people is to exercise caution when you're seeing something that seems on its face to be outlandish or doesn't integrate with what else you know about medicine and science, because everybody has some experience with medicine and science. Make sure it integrates with what you know, and then look for good sources as best you can. Talk to your primary care doctor. That's one thing I can recommend, but it's very, very difficult in today's world.
Understood. Dr. Dalja, thank you so much for your time. Look forward to continuing the conversation.
Thanks for having me.